Hi, you're listening to Irish Stew, the podcast for the global Irish nation. I'm Martin Nutty, and together with my co-host John Lee, we're working to bring all the Irish together, whether you're hyphenated or not. We'll be talking to Irish people of excellence about their lives, what they do, their successes and failures, and how they relate to that small green rock off the coast of Europe. If you like what we're doing in this space, please remember to subscribe to Irish Stew, and even better, leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Irish Stew, the podcast for global Irish nation conversation. I'm John Lee, the co-host, speaking to you from the west side of New York. We will be heading over to the east side of New York and ultimately across the pond to Galway East for our guest interview today. But let's head over to the east side to the co-host of Irish Stew, Martin Nutty.
Hey, John, how are you?
Well,
I'm delighted to have Kieran Cannon on the podcast this week. Kieran is our first elected official on the podcast, and probably most importantly, is coming off a three-year stint as Minister of State, specifically with the diaspora portfolio. And this is quite timely because this past week, the new Irish government diaspora policy was launched, and Kieran's name was mentioned quite frequently as he made major contributions in that particular strategy. What we'll find with Kieran is he's a lot more than a politician. He is a very diverse guy, a lot of interests in other areas such as music, and we'll get into that. So looking forward to it.
Let's get going. Kieran, a big welcome from Irish Stew.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Martin. Delighted to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Martin, since you're better with the Irish terminology and the Irish political designations, why don't you give a brief introduction to Kieran's background?
Yeah, I'm always mindful, you know, that certainly as somebody grew up in Ireland, I'm kind of more familiar with Irish political terminology. So when we talk about Kieran, first of all, he's a TD, which is actually a Gaelic acronym for Teacht an Dáil, which basically means a member of the Dáil. The Dáil is the Irish Parliament, and Teacht an means house. So I guess a member of the House of the Dáil. And so when we talk about TDs, what we're really referring to are members of Parliament, the Irish Parliament. In addition, we probably will talk about the Taoiseach, which is another name basically meaning Prime Minister. So if we throw those things around, you can always hit Wikipedia and kind of find the details in that front. So for people in Ireland, obviously, they're well familiar with this. But if you're in America or England or anywhere else in the diaspora countries, you may not be familiar with those things.
And Kieran, what is your constituency that you represent now?
Yes, John, it's Galway East. It's right on the west coast of Ireland in County Galway. Next stop, the Atlantic. As we often say that around here, the next parish is Boston. But it's a predominantly rural constituency, about 85,000, 86,000 voters. The largest town in the constituency would be Tuam, which is about 6,000 to 7,000 people. So, I mean, in US terms, all of these towns are very small towns. The largest city in the county, but I don't represent the city, is heading towards about 80,000 people. That's Galway itself, which is essentially the economic engine for the whole west of Ireland. A huge amount of foreign direct investment gone into Galway over the last 20 or 30 years. And iconic US companies, for example, like Boston Scientific, Medtronic, now basing themselves in Galway and using Galway as their base for the whole of Europe. So it's predominantly rural. I'm sitting here surrounded by looking out onto green fields. Agriculture obviously features as a huge part of the economy, as does tourism. But increasingly now, certainly with the next generation of young Galwegians, those of their 20s and 30s, they're all working in tech, in life sciences, in medtech, in pharma. And that increasingly is becoming the lifeblood of the economy here in the west of Ireland.
I was in Galway about three summers ago and was impressed by just that, you know, the great historic center of the town, but then the modern kind of industrial parks and tech centers ringing the town. So very impressed.
Yes, it's that I would argue that perfect balance between, you know, recalling its heritage and with great fondness and cherishing that heritage and that history. Reputedly, Christopher Columbus came to dock his boat in Galway before he made his way across the Atlantic. Some of the institutions there are 600-700 years old. And being able to somehow protect that while moving firmly into the 21st century in terms of attracting the best talent in the world, the best investment in the world. And I think a lot of the reasons that some of those particularly US companies are seeking to base themselves here now in Galway is that cultural richness, that diversity of the city, and the fact that it's got two wonderful third level institutions, National University of Ireland in Galway and the Galway Mayo Institute of Technology, again with a pipeline of really talented, really well-educated young people. And again, it's, as I say, it's that kind of diversity of the city, its cultural richness, the scenery here. It's on the beautiful West Coast, on the wild Atlantic Way. So it's got a lot to offer. And thankfully, as I say, many international investors see it that way. So as I say, we're pivoting now from what was a predominantly agricultural region into a region hugely focused on, as I say, medtech, pharma, and IC.
Kieran, we met a few years ago when you were the Minister for the Diaspora and you were over speaking at the Irish Business Organization. You were our featured speaker for the breakfast, and we had to move from the smaller room at the Fitzpatrick Hotel into the main room because of the overflow crowd. And you, I think, were one of our very first followers on the Irish Stew podcast Twitter feed. And I think it might be because we co-opted something that you may have pioneered in your term as the diaspora minister, that sort of hashtag Global Ireland.
Yes.
And I wonder if you might have spotted that, because that's, you know, that's very much our theme. We bill ourselves as a conversation for the global Irish nation. I know the diaspora is a massively important topic for you personally, for the Irish government in general. And we're talking to you a day after the latest five-year plan, I'll call it, was announced for a diaspora strategy. So we'd love to hear, you know, your fingers on the pulse of what is going on and what will be going on in Ireland and beyond for the diaspora.
Sure, John. Ireland is unique, as you know, in having this extraordinary global community. And I'm delighted. And listen, congrats to both of you on getting the podcast up and running. You know, what was apparent to me and what became very apparent to me, certainly when I had the opportunity to visit places like New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Seattle, Auckland, you know, all the places where our Irish congregate all over the world, is the extraordinary opportunity that is presented to us right now to use technology to further solidify and nurture that sense of a global Irish community. And your podcast is an extraordinary development, and I wish you every success. So, and if you look at, just as you say, we've just yesterday, the day before, published our five-year strategy for that engagement with our Irish community of 70 million people all over the world, about 53 million of them in the US, in setting out in very clear terms and very definitive terms how exactly we engage with them, we support them, no matter where they are in the world, in their efforts to develop their Irish community, be it small, be it large, and to allow them to feel a really strong affinity with Ireland, the island, but with also Ireland, the identity, that thing that is very, very precious to all of us. And the leader of my party, Leo Varadkar, as Taoiseach, when he first spoke about our diaspora and how we intended to engage with them in his role as Prime Minister of Ireland 4 years ago, he said that you do not need to reside on the island of Ireland to consider yourself to be truly Irish. And there is that really strong ambition now that no matter where you live in the world, no matter what your background is, and no matter what your personal ambition is in terms of working with your Irish community, you mean the world to us. And we're really, really anxious to work with you in developing and nurturing that sense of Irish identity all over the world. So that's the overarching ambition of the current strategy. There are a number of individual strands. Obviously, we're very, very anxious to continue supporting, for example, the really vulnerable. And there are people right now across the world, perhaps some listening to this, who are on the fringes of communities, of society, wherever they live. I'm thinking of, you know, those undocumented people in the US who live in this kind of strange limbo, a lot of them in deep fear for themselves and for their families. I'm thinking of the elderly Irish construction worker, now in his 70s or 80s, who emigrated to London or Birmingham as a teenager, and again finds him or herself feeling alone and feeling unsupported. So that's a key focus that always has been on those vulnerable people, and working with them and supporting them and investing in organizations at community level who seek to give them a helping hand and reach out and give them that support. So the Emigrant Support Program is a funding mechanism from the Irish state amounting to about $15 million a year, which is invested in supporting vulnerable Irish people all over the world. And that ultimately happens through community groups that have established themselves. And there are many of them in the United States, but history is going back 100 or 150 years. And they are self-sustaining in terms of that they have the personnel, the wisdom, the expertise, the knowledge, and all they need is the additional help of some money to allow them to do the very valuable work that they do. So that's one really, really important element of the work, and that will continue for the foreseeable future. There's also, again, a huge emphasis on culture, because, again, no matter where you go in the world, if you're seeking to gather together a group of Irish people, I would argue you either do one or two. You tell them there's some music happening, or you tell them there's a hurling or a football match happening. I think sport and culture are the glue that binds us all together, no matter where you go internationally. And increasingly so business, which I'll talk about again in a minute. So again, there's an emphasis on supporting the development of Irish culture all over the world. And again, we're very, very fortunate that no matter where the Irish go in the world, they have established these cultural institutions. I'll take an example, for example, the great people in Milwaukee who do that wonderful Irish festival every year. They've made that happen through their own hard work and sweat and tears. And we've come in to support them in a small way. But we want to continue to identify where are the fledgling Milwaukee Irish festivals. For example, the Milwaukee people themselves have now convened a group of festival organizations from across the whole of the US. So, and they are essentially the mothership in Milwaukee. And then you've got these smaller satellite festivals that we want to work with in bringing them up to the scale and the impact of the Milwaukee Festival. So we're actually working alongside them and supporting them financially to make that happen. We also work in partnership with the GAA, and we have a co-funding arrangement where the GAA will invest in a club and we will invest alongside them in terms of developing new facilities. And again, we've seen the fruits of that in the US, in the UK, in Australia, New Zealand. And finally, then, there's a real emphasis in the strategy on what we call our affinity diaspora. And this is a growing little subset of the Irish diaspora community. These are people who have no actual ancestral connection to Ireland, but are deeply fascinated with Ireland, with our people, our literature, our music, our sport, our culture. And some of them have lived in Ireland for a considerable period of time and perhaps returned home. For example, you know, people who come to study in Ireland, in NUIG, in Trinity, in UCD, they may do maybe the end of their degree or a master's, and then they return to the US or UK or New Zealand, wherever it may be. They return to their home countries with a great fondness for Ireland, with a great degree of gratitude for the experience that they've been given in studying and living here in Ireland. And we're increasingly now finding that they want to give back. They want to keep that connection alive. So we're developing now a very substantial alumni network around the world in ensuring that, you know, we can keep those links alive, because these are people who ultimately will be making some very significant decisions around, you know, perhaps big corporations in the future, decisions around R&D, decisions around perhaps where you see third level institutional collaborations happening. So these are all significant decision makers of the future, and we want to continue connecting with them and just acknowledging that their time in Ireland was one that was precious to us too, and we want to keep that relationship going. And also, another element of the work is, if you consider for a moment, John and Martin, that 17% of the people living in Ireland right now were born outside of Ireland. Ireland is becoming a very multicultural, diverse, exciting, colourful, rich place. And that's again reflected in our Irish communities worldwide. It is no longer the kind of homogenous and what we would expect an Irish community to look like. It's multiracial, it's multicultural. And again, we want our five-year thinking to work and see how we can embrace that and develop that and allow those people, every different strand of Irishness, what it looks like, what it sounds like, how it expresses itself, to be considered legitimately Irish, and how we can continue to nurture that sense togetherness and community in the future. So that's just a very quick overview.
That's great, Kieran. And and certainly, obviously, we're aligning with that kind of thinking. Actually, our theme song is done in Irish Gaelic, which starts with Ilan Mór and Domhan Beag.
Domhan Beag, yeah, okay.
This notion that although Ireland, you know, and we're flipping things on its end, Ireland, you know, many people would think of as a small island off the coast of Europe, but its footprint is so big that it makes the rest of the world seem small by virtue of the scale of the diaspora. And we want to magnify that. The other thing that we kind of thought when setting up this podcast was the notion of trying to bind these disparate communities together.
I
find the whole notion of the plastic paddy to be particularly toxic. And so one of the things that I aim to do is to try and basically throw that on the heap of bad ideas and make it go away. But I want to talk more about the diaspora maybe a little bit later. But usually in this podcast, what we try to do is trace the arc of our guests' lives to some degree. So I'm going to kind of roll things back a little bit and kind of talk about, you know, your East Galway origins. I believe you kind of grew up in the Athenry region originally. It's the same area that obviously you represent, the constituency that you represent in the Dáil. But I want to kind of get a sense of that and the arc that ultimately led you to political life.
As you say, Martin, I grew up in a small little village, a place called Kiltulla, population about, I'd say, 400 or 500 people. And when you think of a village in maybe in international terms, I'm talking about, you know, one-off houses just dotted throughout a rural countryside, with perhaps a focal point of the local church, the local pub, and the local post office kind of just sitting in the middle. I was very, very fortunate in growing up in this particular place, because there were in that village at the time, and thankfully there still are, a number of people who wanted to kind of broaden our experience as children and as teenagers of what, you know, what the world looked like, the world felt like. And, you know, we saw things happening in our local, very small rural community that wouldn't normally happen in a rural community. For example, we had a very, very active theatre group. And we produced a piece of theatre every winter. And we would sit around in our local community centre rehearsing, building sets, and we would put on this piece of theatre at the end of that, kind of in the early spring. And then we would tour that around Ireland to places like Limerick, Dublin, Pubbercurry in County Sligo, Shannon, Cork. And again, there was, back then, and there still is a very, very active amateur theatre movement across the whole of Ireland. So we really plugged into that. And that gave me, I suppose, a certain degree of confidence in terms of how I, you know, public speaking and, you know, going on stage and all that. And we also had, we were the first soccer club to be formed outside of Galway City, again, in that small rural community. And I played soccer as a young boy. We also, alongside that, of course, we had our national game of hurling, which was very much ingrained in our local community. You know, when you're, and it still is, when you're born in this part of Galway, as soon as you can walk, you're handed a piece of timber we called a hurl, and it very much becomes part of who you are, what you are, and, you know, the feats and the achievements of previous generations of hurlers are always recalled when talking about local history. My dad played hurling, his dad played hurling, it stretches back for generations. So and eventually then, as a young teenager, we got around to starting our own little youth club in our own local community, in our own village. And I eventually became the chairperson of that at about 16 or 17. And there was a great degree of self-determination encouraged and allowed by the adults who had formed that club. They essentially stepped aside. They said, here's a space. Here's some ideas. You go, you're the young people. You decide how you want to make it happen. And we did. And it was extraordinarily successful. That's what now, that's 40 years ago. It's still working to this day, embracing a whole new generation of local young people. But that gave me a real taste for what can happen when ambitious, visionary, and committed people come together within the community, be it small, be it large, whatever it may be. So that experience always lingered at the back of my mind. I then went off into the college for a while and then into the world of work. And eventually I ended up as the CEO of a national children's charity called the Irish Pilgrimage Trust, which is a charity that provides respite care and holidays for young people with special needs here in Ireland across the whole 32 counties of Ireland. I spent 7 years there. I loved every minute of it. Extraordinarily rewarding work, working with incredible network of volunteers throughout the country. And again, a kind of a further expression of that sense of the mehel. And if you talk to anybody from Ireland and you hear them using the word mehel, it's M-E-I-T-H-E-A-L. It's something that being raised in rural Ireland, anyone would be familiar with. Back in the day when there was no mechanization of Irish farming and when we all had forks and horses and all of that non-mechanized farming practice, when one farm would be about to harvest their corn or their hay, they would call on all the other farmers to come along and give them a hand because it needed to be done in a very short time frame. And then equally so then when the other farmers needed help, everybody else rolled in. Rolled up their sleeves and head. So that's the mehel, that coming together, knowing that when one member of our community needs help, all the others row in behind them. And that kind of stayed with me all through that time with that youth club and again working with this extraordinary national organization. So I began to think then around 2002, 2003, how can I further, I suppose, raise my level of commitment to my local community, to my county? And we had our local elections, and these are our elections to our local county council, which is essentially the seat of local government in our region. And I went for election to that in 2004. Thankfully, I was elected, and I spent 3 years there, which was a wonderful opportunity to learn the ropes of local government and to a certain extent national government. Then I was appointed to the Irish Senate in 2007. And I spent another 4 years there, again, getting a significant greater degree of understanding of national politics, how national government worked. And then I was elected to Dáil Éireann, which is our national parliament in 2011, elected again in 2016, and then just recently, earlier this year again. So in my first term as a TD, as a member of parliament in 2011, I was appointed as a minister, a junior minister in the Department of Education, with responsibility for training and skills, so upskilling our young people to make sure that they had the skills necessary to partake in the ongoing innovation that's happening around the world in terms of ICT and pharma and medtech and all the other skills that they might require. And then, thankfully, in 2016, then I was appointed as Minister for the Diaspora, which gave me that incredible opportunity to get a really deep understanding of how important this diaspora community is, the opportunities that it presents to us here in Ireland and indeed presents to our people around the world. So that's been kind of the story. And all along, Martin, it's been about community. Be it that tiny little village in East Galway with 300 or 400 people or that community of 70 million Irish diaspora all over the world. To me, that's ultimately what my job is to develop and nurture that community and present it with the opportunity for growth, for a greater degree of solidarity, of togetherness, a sense. And I think if we look at, and there are extraordinary examples of what's happened during this pandemic, of how those Irish communities around the world have really, really gone above and beyond the call of duty to support the most vulnerable at a really, really challenging time. So to me, that's what politics is about. It's about just identifying what a community's goals are and what a community's needs are, and then working with that community to make them happen, to bring them into reality. So, and I, many people ask me, how do you enjoy doing what you do? And the bottom line is, I love doing what I do. I enjoy every single day of my work as a member of parliament here in Ireland. I particularly enjoyed my role as Minister for the Diaspora. And the day I stop enjoying it is the day I'll stop doing it.
So the word mehel, as you probably know, is actually bending about quite a bit within the New York community as well.
It is. And I'm delighted to see it happening. Yeah.
It definitely has kind of burnt in here. I'm just curious, because I'm not on the ground in Ireland. Mehel, as you mentioned, has its origins in the more rural communities. Mm. Indeed, more and more people in Ireland are living in the larger cities, and Galway, I would say, is a larger city, and certainly Dublin, you know, is obviously the largest city in Ireland. In a world that's kind of increasingly dominated by digital communications, which kind of, to some degree, cause people to be increasingly isolated on a level, what's your thinking on that in terms of, you know, in the urban environments, how do we kind of, you know, stimulate a notion of mehel? Because I think to some degree, it's a little bit alien to the urban environment.
The concept probably is to a certain extent in that, as I say, it arose from ancient agricultural practices. But I still think, and I know, you know, if you visit, and I do every now and again, you know, local community centres, be it in Dublin, be it in Galway, and indeed many of the community centres I visit in places like Boston, Philadelphia, you know, Seattle, it's there as well. It's perhaps described differently and expressed differently. And you're right, it's more difficult perhaps in past times to see the physical expression of that. You know, nobody's cutting hay or nobody's doing a harvest in the middle of a large city. But I do think that when people, certainly if I look at places like Leeds, Leeds is one example, where we have a very large Irish community, a huge, massive British city. Within that city, we've got a really, really tightly knit Irish community, and they've managed to have a wonderful, the Leeds Irish Centre, a very, very fine facility that has so many functions in terms of outreach, in terms of bringing people in to have social events, in terms of being a cultural flagship for not alone for Leeds, but for the whole Middle England. That's a really urban setting, but that Irish sense of Mehel is very much alive there. So I think it's a kind of a practice that's deeply ingrained in us as a people. And no matter where we go in the world, be it in an urban setting or a rural setting, we find a way of expressing it. So the digital thing is interesting, Martin, because while some might argue it has, as you said, you know, perhaps allowed a sense of loneliness or separation to happen, I think to a certain extent it's presenting another opportunity, and that's a coming together. The very fact that I'm sitting here now in my kitchen in East Galway talking to both of you in New York, I think is an expression of that. The new five-year strategy really has a lot of emphasis on how we can use technology to further bring us together. And I think if you look at the next generation of Irish young people, I have a son living in Philadelphia, and him and I and my mother, his granny, we had a half an hour conversation, a video last night that we just got together, had a chat, the three of us. There's three generations of Irish people communicating using technology. And my mum, who misses him a lot, as you might think, one of her grandsons, she felt very much connected to him after that conversation. And she said she really enjoyed it. And I think we can see an awful lot more of that happening. And I do think, and again, this is emphasized in the new strategy, is our young people around the world, be they, you know, the great-great-grandson of an original immigrant, or be they somebody who has just left college with her laptop under her arm, she now finds herself in Bahrain. We need to work with them as well, because, you know, their sense of what it means to be Irish in 2020, 2021 is perhaps vastly different than what it means to me. I'm in my mid-50s now. Expression of their Irish identity is vastly different. So we've got to find a way of allowing them to express their Irishness in a different way, using a different medium. And I think technology is the way to do that. So the strategy actually provides for the appointment of what we call youth ambassadors. So these are young people, young Irish people around the world who want to work in developing an Irish community and nurturing an existing Irish community, no matter where they are. And we'll then work alongside them. We'll identify who they are. We'll give them the support through our embassy and our consulate network to be able to do that work. We've also seen a really exciting development, I think, is the establishment of Feroiga, which is a national Irish youth organization. Its first ever move outside the island of Ireland was to Philadelphia. And I launched that first ever Feroiga branch in Philadelphia. They're also based now in the Ashling Center in New York. And this is an Irish youth organization that empowers young people, gives them the skills and knowledge to become leaders, civic leaders within their own community. And I think that's an exciting development and something I'd love to see developing further in the US in the next number of years. So while technology does have at times a tendency to push us apart, I think it also can bring us together. And your podcast being one such example, and there are a number of other excellent podcasts beginning to crop up now around the world, driven from within Irish communities. And again, with the intention of bringing us all together and allowing us to, I suppose, to find what matters to us in terms of our Irish identity, amplify it, and present it to the world and say, this is the Ireland of 2021. This is who we are right now. It's perhaps different to the Ireland of, you know, 1981, but that's what it needs to be. And I think through technology is a great way of nurturing that and expressing that.
Kieran, I'm just so thankful for the technology given COVID. In one of my other roles is I am the president of the Irish Business Organization right now, and we hold about 25 events a year, and we haven't missed one. It's all shifted to online. We have our breakfast coming up next week. We have our evening events. We have had parties, and we're able to do things we couldn't do before. We're bringing in, for example, Peter Ryan, the ambassador to New Zealand.
Yes,
who was the person I credit with introducing the methyl to New York when he organized the effort around Superstorm Sandy recovery, methyl.
Yes.
That brought in the New York Irish Center, the Ashling Center, all the Irish publishing groups in New York. I credit him with introducing that idea here, and he helped spark a tremendous unity around a very good cause. But we were able to have him as a guest for our breakfast. We normally
there you go.
It has been a lot of upside, and thank God we were. When COVID was going to happen, we at least had this infrastructure we could turn to. I'm going to ask you about a different little piece of equipment and a different strategy or different direction in your life. Behind you, we're watching you on Zoom, and behind you is a very nice looking piano. And we know you're quite a serious musician. I listened to some piano solo you did on YouTube at something called Tradfest. Very, very impressed with what I heard. And just a kind of a parenthetical. I'm primarily a jazz fan. I really appreciate Irish music, but my roots are as a jazz fan. But I find in Irish music the same thing that excites me about jazz, that sort of improvisation, that playing with the rhythm, that kind of getting as far away from the melody and rhythm as possible. And somehow
and finding your way back.
Finding your way back at just the right time. And if you'll indulge me for one other little personal anecdote, at one point, and a while back, I was trying to learn the saxophone, and I was, fairly self-taught. I'd taken a few lessons, but now I was going to try to get serious with it. And I went to a very good jazz musician, a black guy named Ira Jackson, one of the coolest human beings I've ever hung out with. And so he said, okay, well, play something. Let me see. I didn't even know a melody. I would just improvise along with records. So I just start, doing something. And he goes, after a bit, he goes, okay. Clearly you don't know what you're doing. But he said, but you've got good rhythm. Are you Irish?
Yeah. Ah, that's interesting.
And I was like, okay the stereotype is the black guy normally has the good rhythm. Now he's asking me if I'm Irish.
Said, wow, that's extraordinary.
He said, I find Irish people usually have good rhythm. So just to share that.
That's interesting.
But looking behind you at the piano, that must have been a pull in your life in a different direction. You've managed to incorporate both. But tell us a little bit about the arts of music for you personally.
Okay. And again, I suppose it stretches back all the way to my childhood. My dad was a musician, a traditional Irish musician. He played the accordion. I recall vividly, he worked as a mechanic in a local peat harvesting facility, which is a whole other discussion that could try and explain what that's about. But anyway, a local industrial facility. But he would be listening to the radio in the background all day long. And then he would come home in the evening for dinner. And he'd say, Kieran, go down and get he's very precious accordion, which is always under the bed. Go down and get my accordion. I heard a lovely tune on the radio today. And sitting in the armchair with the accordion, he would have that tune nailed before dinner was ready. Okay. Mm. So that's something he had. And his father before him was the exact same. So every now and again, when dad would be at work, I would sneak down to that very same bedroom and slowly pull the accordion out from under the bed. And I would sit on the edge of the bed and make out my own little tunes on it. And I said, I'm really enjoying this. And you know when something just makes sense to you? There's, you don't have to kind of rewire your brain. It just, everything about it just makes sense. That's the way I felt. So then we had a music teacher come to our local village for the first time when I was about 10. And I kept on at the accordion. Then I eventually moved on to the piano. And then when I was 12, my mom, who will readily admit she has zero musical talent, but because she was the local school teacher, she used to play organ in the church, which is across the road from the school, and she hated it, okay? But it was part of her duty as a school teacher. So she said to me, as soon as you can sit up at that organ, you're taking over from me. So I took over from her when I was 12, and I've played in that church more or less every Sunday for the last 40 years. We eventually got rid of the organ and we brought in the piano, and we do some really kind of contemporary liturgical music now, you know, and we often use Bill Withers' gorgeous song, Lean On Me, some stuff from U2, you know, just a great kind of diversity of influences coming in there. So then about 10 years ago, I started writing my own music, something I really enjoy doing. It's hard work. You know, there are those perhaps, John, who, you know, they're walking in the park or walking by the beach and the muse comes to visit them and these tune. Not the case with me. I like to sit down and really work on something and perhaps take 3, 4, even sometimes 5 or 6 months to come up with a melody I'm really, really pleased with. And thankfully then about 3 years ago, I got to work with Sean Keane, who's one of Ireland's greatest folk singers, renowned around the world, performed all over the world, based here in Galway. And thankfully, in a songwriting collaboration with him and a guy called John Broderick, I was able to work on some pieces for his most recent album. The album is called Gratitude. It was recorded with the RTE Concert Orchestra, our National Concert Orchestra, and I wrote two of the pieces on that album, which is really, for me, an incredible opportunity that I just so, so enjoyed and will always cherish, the chance to work with Sean and our National Orchestra in composing two pieces of music. So music is my therapy. It's that piano you see behind me. I sit into that perhaps for 10, 20 minutes before I go to bed every night and just have a big tinkle. I always leave the phone recording beside me in case something inspirational really comes out of the blue. And it's funny, you know, you mentioned jazz and traditional Irish music, and they are very similar. And they have a history that stretches back to the mists of time. And if you might recall, Philip King, he's an Irish musician and Irish music historian, did an extraordinary series called Bringing It All Back Home. He did it about 15 years ago, where he traced the roots and some of the origins of bluegrass, of jazz, back to Ireland. You know, musicians that had brought their violins and their accordions to the Appalachians, to Tennessee, to Louisiana, down as far as Florida. And somehow or another, that influence, along with, you know, the musical influences from Africa, somehow combined to create this extraordinary new expression, a musical expression that is jazz to this day. And thankfully, there's still a lot of collaboration ongoing to this day between Irish trad musicians and jazz musicians. If you think, and you talk about the saxophone, there's a band called Moving Hearts, which were, again, about 20 years ago, which was really pushing the boundaries of traditional Irish music. And it was the first time a saxophonist found a place in Irish trad, a guy called Keith Donald, D-O-N-A-L-D, incredibly talented jazz musician, but he was brought in to him was a completely alien environment, and he succeeded in bringing that instrument right into the heart of the music, and to this day is acknowledged as a really, really significant contribution. And if you look at the guys like Martin Hayes, and what he's doing with the gloaming, you know, again, a lot of jazz influence is kind of weaving its way through Irish music. So that ongoing kind of cross-pollination is happening. It's great to see. I will always argue, and there are some purists within Irish traditional music who will disagree, but I will always argue that a tradition will stagnate if it doesn't innovate. So you need to be constantly imbuing that musical tradition with new life, new energy, and our young people are brilliant at that. You know, if you sit, perhaps, you know, and I would urge anyone who has a love of Irish music to get to Milwaukee for one of these Milwaukee Irish festivals. It's astounding what's happening there right now. Young people in their teens and in their early 20s expressing themselves through Irish traditional music, but taking it and giving it a kind of a contemporary feel and allowing them to express themselves. And it's a really, really valuable. And if that doesn't happen, the tradition dies. It just stagnates and it's gone. So the purists need to kind of move aside and allow this to happen, because this is why we will still be playing traditional Irish music in 40, 50, 100 years' time.
So, Kieran, you mentioned the fact that you kind of got somewhat involved in liturgical music.
And yes.
When I think of modern day Ireland now, well, let me ask you this. I'm assuming to some degree that, you know, religious belief is an important factor in your life. I'm aware of the fact that you probably took what was considered to be a very difficult vote
on their repeal the Eighth Amendment. And I kind of want to understand a sense of that, because, you know, a lot of times when people talk about Ireland now, they'll kind of talk about the number, the decline in, you know, religious practice. And I want to understand how that fits into your world and what went behind the thinking on the repeal the Eighth vote. And just to be clear for our listeners, repeal the Eighth was basically a vote which talked about the overturning a constitutional amendment, which was the Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, which protected the life of the unborn. So,
yes. We have seen a significant reduction in what you might describe as the formal practice of religion here in Ireland. I mean, attendances at Sunday Mass or Sunday service have reduced drastically over the last 30 or 40 years. That, to me, was the natural outcome of all the challenges that have arisen within the church itself. You know, significant controversies over the last number of years over child abuse, over the way that women were treated in certain settings, in what we call mother and baby homes, because they were deemed to have somehow, you know, contravened some moral code that made them that required them to be shunned and shut away from society. So thankfully, we're coming to terms with all of that now and acknowledging that it was a very dark, very oppressive, very unhappy time in Irish history. But it has had the fallout that religious practice, as I would describe it, that formal expression of it, where people would attend in their hundreds at their local church every Sunday, that's over. And that's not coming back. Certainly, if you look at the next generation of Irish people, those in their 20s and 30s, it's not coming back. But for most communities, and I'm just speaking from my sense of living here still in a small rural community, the church means a lot in terms of that sense of coming together, that reason to assemble, that reason to care about other members of your local community, those that are elderly, those that are vulnerable, those that find themselves on the fringes of those of that society, reach out. It is the very essence of what Christianity is all about. So I think what's happening right now in Ireland is we're seeing a different expression of that Christian faith, of those Christian values. And for me, the value system is what matters. It isn't really how you express it, or whether or not 100 or 200, 200 people turn up to Mass every Sunday. It's how you live your life. And, you know, be it whatever religion you choose to partake in, the underlying ethics, the underlying value system is, to me, what matters in terms of how you live your life. And while, I mean, I'll be frank, and I always am in conversations like this, I seriously doubt if there's any omnipotent being up there looking after our welfare. But what I do fundamentally believe is that we all have a role to play in nurturing, caring, looking after the welfare of others. That's the very, very essence of what being part of society is all about. It's that thread, that common bond that brings us all together. And if we forget about that, well, then what's left to live for? So while I do, as I say, and the more I think about it and the older I become, the more it makes sense to me that there is no wonderful, omnipotent, all-caring, all-seeing thing up there. But that thing where I go on a Sunday morning with 20 or 30 other people and we sing our hearts out in our local church, we enjoy every minute of that, is important to me. And it's my way of saying, I am part of this community. This community matters to me. That's the first thing. Second thing, in terms of the repeal the Eighth and that referendum vote, I took a position on that very, very early, Martin, purely from personal experience. My wife and I tragically lost a little girl. She was stillborn. She had about 7 weeks left to go before she was born. She was lost to us. It was a really horrendous, traumatic time in our lives. And it really gave me a deep sense of the fragility of human life, the vulnerability, and the need to do all we can to protect it. And I, to this day, that question for me was not a question of religion or religious belief. It was a question of morality, as to whether or not you fundamentally believe that all of human life in all of its forms, be it powerful or be it vulnerable, be it born or unborn, is deserving of protection. And that was the position I took. It was a very divisive time in Irish society all while that debate was going on. We came out the other end of it where it was decided to remove that protection from our constitution. I would hope that in doing so, we will continue to be able to cherish human life in all of its frailty and continue to give that kind of protection to our young, our children born and unborn. We put that behind us now. As I say, it was really divisive. It got pretty heated and at times, unfortunately, pretty nasty. But we've all come out the other end. We've moved on and are we a better place because of it? I would hope that we are a better place in terms of we are now less judgmental because we tended to be, 30, 40, 50 years ago, a very judgmental society in terms of women and their place in society. Thankfully, we're moving away from that. And I think this was an important step in that. But I do have doubts as to whether or not we made the right decision. As was how we cope now in the future in terms of legislation for this, in terms of continuing to protect the most vulnerable is important. And that's something I will continue to fight for as long as I have the opportunity to do.
Just as a follow-up, it's refreshing to hear somebody in political life talk about making a difficult decision based on their own particular ethos and the difficulty also of balancing maybe, how your constituents are coming at this particular issue. And yeah. You said it has been effectively decided and essentially, there are other details that are going to need to be mulled over and legislated as time goes on. Was there a political price that you've had to pay for that? How do you see things going forward for you as a result?
Okay, well, that was never a consideration in terms of making my mind up on this. As I say, I made my mind up very, very early on in the debate, arising from the experience of my wife and I in losing that child. And irrespective of what political price I had to pay, I was always going to remain rigidly of that belief, and I wasn't for changing. And what I did all along was I never sought to criticize or try to undermine others for having I'm just simply saying that's your belief and you're perfectly entitled to hold it. Here's mine. I'm just setting it out. That's what maturity, that's what adulthood is all about. You express an opinion based on your own life's experience. And when there's a serious moral judgment to be made, again, all you can do is look to your own life's experience. Look to the experience of those who raised you, their belief system, the things that they held precious and that they instilled in you as being precious, to continue to fight for that. So, did I suffer politically from it? It's difficult to know if I did or not. I was elected just again this year in the aftermath of that debate and in the aftermath of that referendum, which is encouraging because I think there's much more going on in terms of, we're all multidimensional people. And there's much more going on in our lives other than one debate, albeit it was a critically important debate and decision in Ireland's history. But I'll put it this way, Martin, if the discussion was to start again tomorrow morning, I would still adopt the same position. I still have that same belief. It's something that's deeply, deeply important to me. And as I say, from an ethical and moral perspective, as distinct from anything drawn from my religious beliefs, it ran much, much deeper than that, and as I say, out of my own life's experience. I think it was very, very important, and all of those who were on the other side of the debate, particularly most of our political leaders, the vast majority of them, they were very, very careful in the immediate aftermath of that decision, of that referendum, to seek to bring the other side of the argument back into the fold. And look, we've had the decision now, the decision is made, and we now must work together to seek to express that decision as best we can through legislation. So is Ireland a better place as a result of it? It is, I think, in terms of its, particularly its environment as to how it supports women and sometimes a very challenging situation they find themselves in. But as I say, it was a decision I thought long and hard and deeply about and reflected on over and over again. I don't take these decisions lightly. And as I say, it's over now and we move on.
I find that to be a refreshing response because, you know, we're obviously coming off a rather divisive election cycle
yes.
in the United States. And in talking to some of my peers, I kind of, you know, refer to how binary our politics has become in America. And what you're kind of revealing is maybe a slightly more sophisticated electoral response, meaning that there are shades. You might disagree in one with a person on one issue, but agree in general on other issues. And so that tolerance that accompanies the whole difficult, high-intensity emotional kind of issues that is part of political life that at times you have to address. I take great comfort in the fact that people can differ and still come together. So, you know, that's very hopeful to me.
I think that's what politics has to be about. It has to be about mature debate, about people expressing their views through a deeply held value system, you know, the values that shape them. I mean, if you abandon that, well, then what's the point? So you've got to hold that right here in your heart. You've got to cherish it deeply and express it as best you can. And then you make your case, you make your argument, and then you respect the decision. And that's ultimately what democracy is about. You know, and if you look at what I found was so refreshing about Obama in the early days of his presidency was him deliberately reaching out to those on the other side and say, you know, here we are. We've got a country with an extraordinary history and incredible future ahead of it. And we don't need division. Division, you know, is poisonous. Division stunts our growth. Division stunts our capacity as human beings to evolve and to innovate and to make life better for ourselves. So he sought to heal those rifts. And as I think from the early words from Joe Biden, he will seek to do the same. So that's what it has to be about. As you might hear from my words just now, I'm very pleased with the result of the election in the US, as is my son, who lives over there in Philly. And I do think that from the outside looking in, it is the polarity of and that division within American politics that sometimes mystifies us here in Ireland. You know, we are not there. I don't think we could ever go there. It's interesting. And I just think there is that potential. And it's happening in certain parts of Europe now as well, where you are seeing these very, very distinct two poles emerging, far left, far right. I think that isn't where the future of successful politics lies. I think it lies right in the center. And hopefully, you know, I think the educational process is a really important part of ensuring that young people have this perspective, are afforded the opportunity as young people to become better informed as to how societies should work, better informed as to how good politics serves the needs of societies, and then able to express that through how they vote and through how they perhaps partake in political activism and community activism themselves. So I think education is a huge role to play. To be honest, I think education is a solution to most of society's problems. And I think any country that sees itself that divided and really needs to look from 4 to 5 years of age onwards in terms of how you can empower a community to bring about the kind of change that's necessary. It happens right from there onwards. And we've been very, very fortunate here in Ireland to have a wonderful education system for generations now that allows us to do that. But it needs thought, it needs investment, it needs ambition, and no reason to believe that the US doesn't have that. I'm convinced that it does. And I think there's so much to be proud of in terms of what the United States has achieved. It is, for me, the absolute ultimate expression of cultural diversity, that great big cultural melting pot into which, you know, millions of people found themselves immersed and succeeded and lived side by side and have created something really special and really unique. But I think the US right now needs to look at itself. Those who are the leaders within the US political system, their function is not to sow further division, to further push those two poles apart. It is the exact opposite. And I think, thankfully, there are enough people within United States politics who realize that and are willing to work to make that happen.
Kieran, I'm old enough as the American here. I'm old enough to remember when it wasn't always that way. You know, despite some horrendous divisions, there was reaching across the aisle. You know,
there was mutual respect.
There were times where I would find myself voting for the opposition party because that candidate was better. You know,
so exactly.
I share your hope. Things can only go so far. You know, at the IBO, the Irish Business Organization, our last meeting, we had someone who worked with Cooperation Ireland.
A great organization.
Ireland body that seeks a lot of reconciliation. And I was...
Where do they start, John? They start at the children. They start
exactly,
with children.
Exactly. And this, the person who was speaking was a kind of a graduate of that program many years ago and carried on this. And I was looking at some of the programs about bringing disparate groups together. And I, you know, somewhat facetiously asked him, any chance you could run some of these programs in the U.S. because we need that. We almost are at that point where we need like reconciliation to
get
people back together. Kieran, we covered a lot of great topics here. Really interesting stuff. And appreciate you diving deep on some of this with us. We like to end things by offering our guests a shameless plug. Is there anything coming up in your life that you'd like people to know more about?
Well, now that you mentioned it, John. my songwriting collaborations continue, thankfully. It's a great something that really means a lot to me. And I'm collaborating right now with a lyricist and a singer, an extraordinary singer called Michelle Lally, who incidentally performed for President Obama in the White House and also performed for President Bush in the White House. She's performed with De Donnan, the Chieftains, extraordinary talented woman. Usual voice, God's gorgeous voice. So we've written a Christmas song. Now it's a Christmas song with a particular Irish and Galway flavour. It's seated in Galway City and refers to some places in Galway City that are very familiar to Galwegians. We wanted to go international. We wanted to become one of the quintessential Irish Christmas songs, and it's called Old Galway Town, and it's being released on the 4th of December. So if you go into Facebook and look for Old Galway Town, you'll find us there. And if you have any connection to Ireland or particularly to Galway, we would love for you to join us in that Facebook page. We'll be doing a kind of a little launch event and a few rolling into the launch events. And we're in the middle of recording a video now, and that's ongoing as we speak. And the whole thing will be going live on the 4th of December. And we would love from people around the world, particularly Galwegians from around the world, to share it. And it's essentially about a woman sitting in a cafe, stirring her cup of coffee, thinking about where life has taken her, and perhaps reflecting on past love, past relationship, but now acknowledging that where she is right now in life is where she's always wanted to be, and that sense of contentment with where you are right now. And it's, I suppose, at a time when we've all been challenged and we've all been thrown apart by the pandemic and don't have that opportunity to embrace one another and come together. It's exactly about how special and how important that opportunity is. Well, Old Galway Town, we're on Facebook. We'd love for you to join us there and be part of that journey over the next couple of weeks.
And we'd love to share this with our audience in any way on our social media platforms, on our blog. We'd be happy to share this, and we look forward to, and thanks for the invitation.
And listen, thanks to you and Martin. This has been a really enjoyable conversation. You are doing right now, and you may not realize this, but what you're doing through your podcast is really valuable and impactful work. I wish you every success in it, and you have my support for whatever it needs to make Irish Stew become one of the go-to diaspora podcasts. There's no reason why that can't happen. It's obvious that both yourself and Martin have exactly that in mind. And your sense of what we need to do to bring us together as a people internationally is so well-tuned and ambitious. So look, I wish you every success, and thank you for allowing. This is a privilege for me to be part of this one of your early podcasts. Thank you so much.
No argument for me, Martin. What about you?
Thank you, Kieran. It's just a great opportunity, I think, in the podcast world to get beyond kind of like, you know, veneer questions and kind of really probe a little bit deeper and find us and kind of speaking from the heart. Certainly shone through to me during this podcast. And we hope, again, maybe to have an opportunity some point in the future to sit down again and kind of like take the temperature in terms of the diaspora. And you know where we are maybe a year later. So we definitely look forward to that.
Okay, Mark. Thank you so much. Thanks, John. Take care.
Thank you, Kieran.
Well, John, I really enjoyed that conversation with Kieran. And my takeaways from this are really kind of two key words you see cropping up in the course of that whole conversation. One is metal, and the other is community. And those two things are clearly linked. And of course, during our conversation, you can see, based on the arc of Kieran's experience in life, how community and metal have kind of blended ultimately into a career in public service. And that notion, although is more associated with agricultural communities, how valuable that is to bring into our kind of increasingly urban world. And how Kieran is a forceful advocate for that sense of community, which can scale up into the digital world in which we operate. So we want to get metal away from the farm, obviously retain it in the farm, but we also want to carry it forward into the urban environment and into the digital environment, which we certainly find ourselves operating during a time of COVID.
For me, the two words will be culture and diaspora. You know, always so impressed the way culture makes an appearance in Irish events, in Irish business events, and also how it is such a great part of Ireland's soft power. It's a culture that's easily transportable. The song in your heart, the poem in your head, that is able to really be a calling card for the Irish brand. And Kieran's an amazing representative of that. He's a serious musician and he really loves playing music, and it comes across. And then mentioning culture as part of the diaspora, Kieran is a really valuable source for original thinking about how the diaspora for Ireland can be engaged. And I believe he's the first person that I heard use the term global Ireland. We use that as a hashtag on our social media. And from the kind words he said about what we were up to, I can see that we are very much on the same page in terms of diaspora. And dipping back to culture for a minute, he mentioned the song, Old Galway Town. Well, this episode of Irish Stew goes live after his launch party, but you can still go to his Facebook page, Old Galway Town. And this is one holiday season. We need something fresh. We need a treat, and we need a song for the season. It's going to be Old Galway Town, and I recommend you log on to Facebook and give this song a listen and enjoy it throughout the rest of the season.
Couldn't agree with you more. I think we're all in need of some seasonal cheer.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us for another Global Irish Nation conversation. To see what we're stirring up next, follow us on Twitter at Irish Stewcast or like us on Facebook at Irish Stew Podcast. And you're very welcome to join Martin Nutty and me, John Lee, anytime for another serving of Irish Stew.
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.